Observations, a program designed to introduce our listeners to God, a program designed for those who already know Yahweh to help all of us understand who God is even better, a program designed to share why He created the universe, what He wants, to communicate what He's offering so that those of us who have not yet capitalized on His gift could know how to do so. A program designed to communicate the past, the present, and future as it relates to not only human history, but God's interaction with mankind. And so as we left the last segment, we were talking about what it means to come first to reject faith and belief and ignorance and to come to know who God is based upon what He has revealed.
Belief are both pagan concepts.
They are.
They're just, you know, when you walk out of Babylon and you come to the realization that faith and belief are pagan concepts, you know, it's pretty profound. And then you think about it and you go, well, that was obvious.
Yeah, when you recognize that Paul, who wrote in Greek, never communicates and his words in any language other than Hebrew. Now, we can translate his Hebrew communication into other languages so long as we understand the nuances of Hebrew and we understand the accurate meaning of the words that he deployed in Hebrew and to define and describe those words as accurately as and completely as possible in the other language as we are transitioning from Hebrew into English in this program. Paul wrote in Greek, and Paul used a Greek word that at one time was equivalent to trust and reliance. It was pistos, the Greek term. But because of the application of pistos in Paul's letters and the fact that Paul is the basis of the founder of the Christian religion, the most popular religion in human history, the word that he used, which at one time meant trust and reliance, now is understood as faith and belief. And it's why the most popular religion, Christianity, is known as a faith. It's a belief system. In fact, Christianity and faith, Christianity and belief are absolutely inseparable concepts. And the thing that most people do not understand is that Paul urges those who had listened to him and who read his letters to believe him, and yet he provides absolutely no basis, no information that would provide any explanation or any credibility, any basis for knowing, any basis even for believing. So belief in Christianity is a leap of faith into the darkness where there is absolutely no basis for it. In fact, you look about how many Christian concepts are that way, that have no basis in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, or of any of God's inspired testimony. Can't be found in Yosha's testimonies, can't be found in anywhere, at any place in God's communication to us. Let's just talk about a few of those. How about church? Is there a reference to anything even remotely akin to a church coming from Yahweh?
No, not.
How about from Yosha?
There's things he discusses that describe churches, but they're always in highly negative terms. And of course not. Yosha, it is preposterous to believe that Yosha, who railed against the religious, who railed against religion, invented one based on the life.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate here, literally devil's advocate. I read in my my book named Bible, that Jesus Christ said to Peter that upon this rock I will build my church. So he must have a church if he said, I will build my church. How can
that's
how can he not have a church
writing,
if that's If he said that,
writing on a piece of paper, he said he spoke Hebrew, and he said, upon this rock I will build my mikre, which would be the equivalent of the Moed mikre, and that was translated to ecclesia, which meant called out assemblies like Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and so forth. And then they just copy edited it to a church after they wrote Kakurin, I believe. So they replaced one Greek word with another Greek word and then went to church. But I think somebody I read once said that's as curious, you know, replacing one Greek word like ecclesia with another Greek word is as curious as translating Torah to tadpole.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
Isn't that true?
So what we're saying here is that Yosha spoke only one language. Could he have spoken other languages? Yes.
Sure.
Did he speak other languages?
No. Nope.
No. He spoke one language. It was Hebrew. Now, I understand that there is a place where it says he said, my God, why have you forsaken me, in Aramaic. Do you know that Hebrew and Aramaic are so close that, for example, in the book of Daniel, which is the only book that contains any Aramaic testimony, that the verbs are essentially identical and the nouns are spelled almost identically. That the difference between Hebrew and Aramaic is extraordinarily small. And so to read Aramaic, if you can read Hebrew, you can read Aramaic, and vice versa. And in all likelihood, the account of him speaking Aramaic on, my God, why have you forsaken me, is a person not recognizing that, not understanding Hebrew, understanding Aramaic, and mistaking the Hebrew for Aramaic. But even that one statement, the reason we know he spoke it in Hebrew is, in that particular case, he was not asking a question. He was not asking, my God, why have you forsaken me? What was he instead doing, guys?
He's quoting 22?
Yeah, correct. He was quoting the opening line from Psalm 22. The opening line of Psalm 22 is what he was quoting. Why did he quote the opening line of Psalm 22 in Hebrew?
It was the prophetic. It was the prophetic the picture of what was going to happen on Passover.
Yeah, he was at that very moment.
He was
fulfilling that eyewitness account of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. And as a matter of fact, Psalm 22 is not just a depiction of what was occurring at that moment on Pesach and what had just occurred on Pesach, Passover. It is also a prophetic announcement of what would occur on Matzah. In fact, it spends a considerable amount of time on Matzah and then concludes with Bikurim. So it is the most accurate eyewitness account of what he was doing. So he was telling you, if you want to understand what I'm doing, look at the statements that I authored 1,000 years ago to the day about what is occurring here, Psalm 22. So he spoke Hebrew. So, when we read in something like Matanyah, Matthew, did Matanyah write his account of Yosha's words and deeds in Greek or in Hebrew?
Hebrew.
Right. And we know he wrote it in Hebrew because there are not only rabbinic, but many historical testimony of how his account was originally written in Hebrew and then later translated into English. Do you know why we don't have a copy of what he wrote in Hebrew?
Yes, the rabbis burned them all.
That is correct.
They brag about it in the
right.
Talmud.
Yeah, the Romans burned copies of the Torah. They soaked copies of the Torah and water, and then wrapped it around people, and then burned them alive, anyone who could read Hebrew, because the Roman empires and the Roman Catholic Church's most feared enemy was Yahweh and his Torah. So anybody who could read Hebrew, they killed, and they destroyed all copies of the Torah. But it was the rabbis themselves who destroyed copies of Matanyah written in Hebrew. And the Mishnah and the Talmud are filled with testimony of how they dealt with the first followers of Yosha, who spoke and wrote in Hebrew. So when Matanyah was quoting Yosha, He did not say, upon this rock I will build my church. He said, upon, which is all, this Zoth, specific, Sur, T-S-U-W-R, this rock, which is also the rock of our Sadak, or uprightness, or salvation, I will build, which is E-Bana. Bana means to create, to establish a family home. I will build my Mikra. And we know it was Mikra because, as you said, what is the Greek word that was used to translate what Yosha said in Hebrew?
Oh, that's the...
Ecclesia.
Ecclesia, yes.
Right. And what does Ecclesia mean?
Helpful. It means called out assemblies.
Right. Called out assemblies. And when, what is the simplest definition of kara, which is the basis of Mikra?
Separate.
To call out.
To call out and invite. Yep.
Yeah, to call out. Now, as is the case, and this is why we talked about this, as is the case with every Hebrew word, we can convey in English what Yahweh said in Hebrew, so long as we understand what he said in Hebrew. Kara is the term that he used as the basis of Mikra. So if we want to understand what he said, we have to consider, closely examine and carefully consider the meaning of Kara in the title Mikra, to understand what he said, that upon this rock I will build my Mikra. You're not going to get that understanding from Ecclesia Greek, because he did not communicate in Greek, he did not speak Greek, he did not share this message in Greek, and therefore you need to just leave the Greek alone once you realize that that Ecclesia does not mean church. There is no connotation, association of any kind between Ecclesia and church. Church is like, as you said, Larry, it's like replacing Torah with tadpole. I mean, that's how far afield it is. Church is based upon the name of the daughter of Helios, of the sun, in the Germanic religions. It's the basis of circuit and circus and circle, as the circle of the sun. And Church was the daughter of Helios.
Yeah, and that's why when Yahweh returns, he says they've been burned and blinded by the sun. And
they have, correct.
I mean, he's talking about the sun god religions,
right.
You know, Mithraism and all
the rest. Why he condemns Babel, that Babel means confusion. The basis of the word that Christians use to describe their holy text, Bible,
mm-hmm.
It means confusion. So what Yosha said is upon this rock, I will build, establish the family associated with my Mikra. He was telling us that the Mikra, or plural Mikre, were going to be the basis of establishing the family. How many Mikre are there?
Seven.
Which is the first one of them?
Pesach, Passover.
What happened the following day?
That would be Matzah.
Right. Then the day that he spoke this, he actually spoke it on Pesach, because he had just left having dinner, the Pesach dinner, with his chosen disciples or learners, correct?
Yep.
And, in fact, as he said this to Shimon, he was headed to that event. So he had just celebrated Pesach dinner, and he was about to be the Pesach lamb. And so he's telling us that Pesach is, in fact, the first step in building the family. And it is, because we're mortal. We have to become immortal. That's the purpose of Pesach. What's the second of these Moed Mikre? What was he going to endure the following day?
Sheol.
Yeah, Matzah. And he was going to go to Sheol to remove the corruption of politics and religion from our soul. And how do we know that yeast, which is a fungus permeating the bread, represents human corruption? Did Yosha explain that?
And from Egypt,
he did.
Yeah, but also, didn't he tell us, as he was talking to his disciples, and his disciples, he asked them, you know, do you have any bread? And they said, oh, my God, we forgot the bread. And they were having a conniption fit, and he said, wait a minute. Come on, guys. I've been with you all this time. Don't you know that if I wanted to make bread, I'd just make bread? I'm talking to you about, do you understand what the bread, and particularly matzah, unyeasted bread, represents? He says, do you not understand that the yeast represents the scribes and the Pharisees, which is politics and religion? That's what the yeast represents. And he told them as they were sailing on the Sea of Galilee that the yeast represents politics and religion. It is removed on matzah. Yahusha is removing politics and religion from us when he fulfills matzah. What's the third of the Moed Mikre? When he speaks, he says, upon this rock I will build my Moed Mikre.
First fruits.
Yeah, the third is first fruits. Firstborn child is from Bakar. It means the firstborn, and it's YM, which is plural in Hebrew. So it's firstborn children. This is about a family. And who was the first child born into the family of children of God?
Yahusha. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, so he became the firstborn into Yahweh's covenant family. And as a new child in that family, was he recognizable to anyone?
No, he wasn't.
Oh. No, as a matter of fact, you know, at the garden, the women that had spent all of those years with him did not recognize, mistook him for the gardener. When
he was the gardener. Now, right. Can you imagine that your son that you raised, that mm-hmm. you loved, mm-hmm. was murdered in front of you mm-hmm. in a gruesome crucifixion,
right.
And the next day you don't recognize him?
Yeah. Zero possibility of that unless he was no longer in the same body. That body had to have been destroyed. And he was now in an entirely different body. And when he walked into the empty room with the learners, the disciples that he had spent 3 years with, did they recognize him?
Nope.
Hey, well, if you had a body, could you walk through a wall?
Only if I was a Shaolin priest.
Yeah. By the way, you know, if Yosha had that same body that he walked through the wall, how would he have been affixed to the upright pole that was Pesach?
He couldn't have been.
Couldn't have been, could he? If he had that same kind of body, how could he have been whipped?
Couldn't happen.
Right. So he walked through the wall, was not recognized. In fact, at the end, when he shows up for breakfast with the fellas, after they have failed to recognize him in the upper room, the evening of Pesach, actually now it's the following day, when he met with them for breakfast sometime thereafter, now he's already shown up and they've already seen him now. Post-crucifixion, post-Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, did they recognize him when he showed up for breakfast?
Nope.
Even nope.
When he met with the two guys on the road to Emmaus that had witnessed the last year of Yosha's life and had witnessed the crucifixion, and he accompanies them and begins to chat with them about all that they have seen, and they say, man, you know, they tell him, they said, are you clueless as to what's happened these past 3 days? And he turns to them and says, are you guys morons? You have no idea who I am? They didn't recognize him either, did they?
No, and they never would. I mean, you know, they began to understand after all this. I mean, you know, they were in a tizzy. They were blown away. They didn't understand it. And of course, you know, when you're seeing something supernatural like that, I can understand that. I really can.
And because, you know, if God's intent were to create a religion based upon Easter Sunday, and by the way, Bikurim only occurs on the first day of the week, on average, once every 7 years. So this idea that Yahweh has a Good Friday and an Easter Sunday says that you're clueless as to what he was doing and what days he was fulfilling these promises. But this idea that God was resurrected is utter and complete nonsense. Because if that was the purpose, that his body was brought back from the dead and that he was back in his physical body, then the testimony we would have been given would have been the antithesis of the testimony we have been given. They would have said they recognized him as opposed to no one recognized him. But the eyewitness accounts that were written 1,000 years earlier in Psalm 22 and Psalm 88 and Yeshaya 53 and 54, doesn't it say that that after Matzah, that he would be reacquainted with the light?
Mm-hmm.
So the set-apart spirit
exactly
that left him
says. It
at
says
the
soul was ransomed in Sheol, and it met back up with the light. That's exactly what it says.
Right. Yeah. So the set-apart spirit that had left him on Pesach, because God cannot die and God cannot go to the place of separation, the set-apart spirit that left the body and soul of Yosha on Pesach was reunited, not with the body, but with the soul of Yosha, when it was released from Matzah to create Bukudim, and it was that new integration of set-apart spirit and which is energy, light, and the soul of Yosha that was manifest to the disciples and to the women in his life. And that's why they didn't recognize him. He was not who he had been physically. There was no resurrection. What happened to the body?
It was disintegrated.
Disintegrated. It was destroyed.
Yeah, according to the Pesach instructions, it was burned up in the fire.
Yes, it was. Gone. So there is no body.
So Paul does, all he does is he says, God's dead, long live the new God.
Right.
Who becomes Jesus, the Son of God.
And the sole representative of the new God, of course, is Paul.
Yeah.
Who condemns everything that the old God said and did.
Well, it's so obvious, though.
Yes. Well, once you recognize, once you're your eyes are open, your mind is open, once you you realize that there is a 0% possibility that God would have chosen someone to not only contradict him, but to condemn everything that he previously said. Once you recognize that it is irrational, stupid, ridiculous to think that the Creator God of the universe was incapable of saving, that it was incapable of coming up with a plan that would work, and that he needed a pathetic man who, by his own admission, was insane, demon-possessed, murderous, and perverted to come up with a plan because he couldn't. And that is Christianity, folks. That's what is written in Galatians. That is what's written in Romans. That's what's written in Corinthians. Once you come to realize that's preposterous because your mind is open, you're going to deal with the information rationally, that there is no possibility whatsoever that that could have occurred, and that Paul's writings not only contradict him, contradicts his own writing, but Yahweh's testimony, then you realize that Christianity is the plague of death, just as Yahweh said it would be.
And it brings us right back to Christmas.
Yeah, in fact, in Jeremiah, which is an open book to Gentiles, it's the only one of the books in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that was specifically addressed to Gentiles. What does it say of the Christmas tree?
Well, it says don't.
What it says is never follow these people. It's delusional. That's
right.
Delusional. That's what it says.
Yahweh says this idea of chopping a tree down and propping it up in one's, bringing it into one's home and propping it up so it doesn't teeter, and the decorating it with ornaments of silver and gold and showing reverence from it is moronic. It's offensive. It's just inane. It's stupid. And then speaking of the Christian New Testament, how does he, in that same book, in the 31st chapter, how does he go about condemning the very notion that he would have a New Testament based on faith that was contradictory to his Torah?
So when he says it's totally complete and lacking nothing?
Yeah. Well, when he says in Jeremiah 31, he says, that when he reaffirms his covenant, that he will do so with, he doesn't say the Gentiles or with the church, does he?
He says Israelites and Yehudim.
Right. And not only does he say that, but then he says that the only difference between the covenant as it was through Abraham and the covenant as it will be the day that he returns, there's only one difference. And what is that one difference?
inside us.
Pardon?
Yeah, it's inside us.
Yeah, he writes his Torah inside of us. And so, since God has not yet done that, that means that the covenant has not been renewed. And it also means, since it's the Torah that is being that's being written inside of us, when the covenant is reaffirmed, that is the distinctive feature, that means that there is a zero possibility that Yahweh discarded the Torah to go to a New Testament, only to return to the Torah, which the New Testament says is the Nept. So the book written to Gentiles completely destroys the myth of a New Testament that is different than the Torah. Because it's his return, his reaffirmation of the covenant is based on the wholesale integration of his Torah. Do you fellows know why God couldn't just do that now? Why couldn't he write his Torah inside of us now? Now, you and I, we can put his Torah inside of us now.
Mm-hmm. Because that would take away choice.
That's correct.
That would, we have to have choice right to the end.
Right.
You know.
Do you think that Yahweh wants to deal with humanity as we are? When was Yahweh's last expression about vicious, militant, religious, political man? What was his last testimony against humankind that had degraded to that point? What did he have to say about it?
You mean during the flood or
the point during the flood? Yeah.
He said he's going to destroy it.
Right. He says, because I grieve that I'd even created them. Do you think God wants to grieve forever and spend all eternity with the mankind as we are?
No, it's too painful.
It would be too painful. And so the reason that he created instructions that Noah chose to follow and act upon that saved Noah and his family from the malicious nature of humankind was to say that he has a plan, which is designed to do exactly the same thing for us. If we wish to distance ourselves from humankind, if we wish to listen to what Yahweh has to say, if we wish to act upon it, then we too can be saved from the viciousness and the putrid, perverted nature of religious and political and militant man to spend eternity with God, because God only wants those who have rejected the things that grieve him being part of his eternal family. Otherwise, it would be miserable for all of us. So, guys, what is the first condition of the covenant consistent with the story of Noah, consistent with the story of Abraham, consistent with what we've just said about God?
Two words, walk away.
Walk away. And he says specifically, walk away from your country. Mm-hmm. What country was Abram in?
Babylon.
Yeah, Ur of the Chaldeans. Chaldean is the term that Yahweh uses to describe the integration of Assyria and Babylonia and Sumer as they had become one integrated monstrosity. And the word for Babel, it means ba in Hebrew, is with or in. And Bel in Hebrew is the Lord. So it's with the Lord, in the Lord. And to be with the Lord and in the Lord, because Baal in Hebrew is the name and title of Satan, means with Satan and in Satan. And then as a verb, what does Babel mean?
Confusion. Babel.
Yeah, confuse. Right.
To confuse. It's Babel's own.
Right. And so this is what Yahweh specifically says, that unless you are willing to walk away from your country, and that country representing Babylon, confusion, being with the Lord, being with Satan, then you are not welcome to engage in a relationship with you. He will not engage in a relationship with you. He'll invite you. I mean, he invited all of us to be part of his family, gave us the invitation to be part of his family while we were still in Babylon, all of us. But unless we were willing to walk away from Babel, from confusion, from being influenced by Satan's politics and militarism and religion, that would be the end of the conversation. First requirement to being part of the covenant is to walk away from Babel. That means from your Bible, That means away from your Lord. It means away from your country, away from societal customs, away from religion, away from politics, away from militarism. All of the things that Yahweh specifically condemns in the book of Jeremiah, of Jeremiah. The entire book is written to condemn those things. I think that is the hardest thing for the vast preponderance of people to do. You know how hard it is to disassociate from Christianity in this culture?
Oh, I do. I've shared over 80 passages with two religious whores right now.
Yeah.
And they say, you think you're impressive because you have parentheses. I said, those are what the words mean. There's no way around them. They 100% oppose Yahweh's words in advance of Babylon.
We'll be back in a moment and continue to talk about the terms and conditions of the covenant.